Chapter 4. Ringing True. Time and sun were both creeping away with terrible, inexorable speed. Rob hadn't spoken falsely to Mance Rayder. He knew his work, and he knew what needed to be done to hold a keep against a siege. But he was also only one man, and now, with 19 castles to hold, most of them halfway to being ruins. And he'd have to defend every last one, because the enemy had the men to attack them all at once and still outnumber him 10-1 at each place. He'd picked the best men he could to hold each castle, and spoken with them together before he'd sent them out. But that itself was a price he could ill afford to pay. He'd even had to send Lord Bolton to Greenguard, even though he knew the man was still only polite and unconvinced. The rest of the scouting expedition had never returned, Bolton's own man among them, and he plainly didn't believe what John had told them of the army of the dead. And Rob couldn't even send some of the free folk along to help him hold the place. Bolton had made too clear what he thought of putting wildlings on the wall, except as heads mounted on pikes. But he at least understood how to hold a castle against a siege. And half the men Rob had sent to take commands didn't. He'd had to take them over Castle Black from top to bottom and do his best to give them 10 years of study in a week's time. And all of it seemed at once necessary and futile. A million men. A million corpses, each one of them nearly impossible to kill. The only thing they had that would do it quicker than hacking them to pieces was Valyrian steel, and they didn't have nearly enough of that. And the enemy would attack them everywhere at once. If the defenses failed at even a single keep, they would go pouring through, and then onward onto all the realms of men. There was nothing to do but the best he could do, so Rob meant to do that, and hope it was enough. But he knew in his heart that it wouldn't be, not against such numbers. And he thought too many of the men did as well. They weren't fools, and the flow of men and grain from the south had now nearly stopped. There hadn't been another of the grain ships in 3 weeks, Lady Mormont reported, and new arrivals had slowed to a mere trickle, a few dozen men coming each day, by twos or threes, or sometimes even alone. Rob welcomed each one of them, for these were men of true valor, who had marched north to join the fight without a single oath of service to require it, and in the teeth of the king's anger. He honored them and was grateful for them, but they too wouldn't be enough. All of Westeros should have risen to the call. That alone might have saved them. Still, he went down each time when he heard the gates opening, to show them respect. And that morning, he had to pause in some surprise when he came into the courtyard and found Tyrion Lannister climbing down from a wagon seat amid a motley gathering of other volunteers who'd traveled north with him from King's Landing. It wasn't a pleasant surprise either. Rob half wanted to seize him and demand what gall had brought him here when his brother, the Kingslayer, was holding a sword to his father's throat. But he couldn't do that, because he'd sent out the call and Tyrion had come in answer. If he meant to prove a man of honor, he couldn't be turned away, not for pride or wrath, and no matter what little help he might be. So Rob said stiffly, "You are welcome, Lord Tyrion," and even made himself ask him into the hall and offer him a glass of wine, as was due his rank, while the steward sorted out places for the others. "I thank you for any aid you can give." "Try to restrain your enthusiasm," Tyrion said dryly. "Surely, when you're facing the Night's King, you can't afford to pass up any help at all. Speaking of which, thank you, Clegane," he added, as the big man with the scarred face came in carrying 3 chests from the wagon, and Tyrion's squire came trotting on behind him with the 4th. They put them down on the floor beside the table. Tyrion put down his glass and opened one of them, with a single volume on top of a soft cloth, marked with a wide strip of blue cloth tucked inside, and he opened it up and handed it over. "I've been doing a great deal of reading for you. This is the most relevant text I've found." Rob read through the passage and shook his head a little. "Aye, Maester Aemon's told us of this dragon glass. It's mentioned elsewhere in the annals, but we've no idea how to make it, and there aren't any dragons to do it with if we did."
"You don't need to make it," Tyrion said. "I asked around the Citadel, and a maester who specializes in the study of fire mountains immediately told me that it's a kind of stone that comes out of them. Apparently, when there's a flow of molten rock, it often turns into the stuff as it cools. And he had quite a substantial collection, of which I took the liberty of relieving him." He indicated the rest of the chest, covered with a thick blanket, and Rob flung it back to find it full of black stone shards, some of them already formed into arrowheads and spear points. He slowly reached down and picked one of the spear points up. The stone was smooth and odd and strange in his hand, and his heart beat with sudden quickness. "I cleaned out all of the Citadel and whatever I could find of the stuff in King's Landing," Tyrion said. "And I also sent away to Essos for some more. If my agents there can find any, they'll have it shipped to Eastwatch. There is a substantial supply in Westeros, but it's on Dragonstone."
"Where Robert's brother Stannis rules," Rob finished. He could hardly look there for help, but he already felt a desperate urgency. They had to get more somehow. After a moment, he took out his dagger and ran it over the edge of the spear point. A piece flaked off easily, with very little pressure. "This wouldn't be any use against steel, and it's too brittle to use for building, surely." "So far as Maester Cardin knew, the stuff was almost completely worthless," Tyrion said. "It's a curiosity, not a practical material." "Then I'll write Lord Stannis and ask him if he'll send us more, since it's nothing we can use against the king," Rob said. "He can only refuse."
"I suppose that's true," Tyrion said.
"However, before you go to the trouble, you might want to make sure it works first. I wasn't exactly able to run any experiments on dead men." Rob met his own gaze in the glossy surface, his face looking back out of it like a dark mirror. Somewhere, far away and deep, and he didn't need an experiment to make sure of it. There was a strange warmth in the stone beneath his fingers, even in the cold room, strange and yet half familiar. "We'll make a trial of it," he said, "but it'll work." He looked up at Tyrion. "Forgive me, I was ungracious and a fool besides. If we can hold them, it'll be because you brought this to us. Thank you." Tyrion studied him with a slight frowning.
"That, if, sounds remarkably skeptical. As I understand it, you have 200,000 men and a very large wall."
"I do," Rob said grimly. "And the enemy will outnumber us 10 to 1 at every castle along it."
"You've seen their forces."
"We sent 12 men," Rob said. "They sighted them in the Valley of the Milkwater, and only Jon made it back alive to tell us." He looked at Tyrion, who was frowning more deeply.
"Not good enough, I imagine."
Tyrion glanced up at him, a little startled, as if he'd imagined that Rob didn't understand that he'd also come to learn more of what's going on. "And send word back south." Rob shook his head.
"You're welcome to speak to Jon, or to our rangers and scouts, but if you went out there to try and sight them yourself, you wouldn't come back. And even if you did, do you really think any message you send will make a difference? If King Robert would believe that my father connived at treason against him, he's wandered so far from the truth that he'll not recognize it again until the Night's King is marching up to his throne to cast him down."
Tyrion's face had gone bleak, his mouth turned down, and he said, after a moment, low,
"You haven't been lying at all, have you? They're really coming."
"In 3 months more, you'll be able to see them from the top of the wall with your own eyes," Rob said.
But even if your brother and sister believe you then, and they persuade the king, it'll be too late for them to do anything at all, but flee further south still, or take a ship for Essos, and hope that the sun returns before the Night's King finds a way to reach them. And then he'll take the Iron Throne, which the king's been so jealous to defend against those who don't want it. He spoke savagely, thinking of Father locked away in the dark. They'd given him a traitor's cell, in chains, because if he weren't in chains, he'd still be trying to come north. Ever since Rob had sent out the call, it had become a living thing inside his own chest, of a cold, bright pressure, insistent and terrible. And the only thing that eased it was the certainty that he was doing everything he could. And Father was the first in the line. So that pressure would be worse still for him. But he wouldn't ever refuse the call. He'd never turn away, which would give him release from it. Because Rob knew that if he died here in the north, along with Uncle Benjen, if he was even still alive somewhere beyond the wall, and Bran fell afterwards at Moat Cailin, trying to hold against them there, then when King Robert finally did let Father out, he would still be able to answer the call when the Night's King came to the south. And if he'd refused it already and therefore couldn't, then it would land on Sansa and Arya and Rickon instead. They'd be the only ones left to answer it. So Father would suffer in the dark instead, pulled to the limits of his bonds until they were opened at last, only to let him give his life in service of the man who'd betrayed him. Bitterness was thick in Rob's throat, and when Tyrion said, "Stark," and Rob looked down, he'd clenched his hand, and the edge of the dragonglass was sharp as a razor. Thin lines of blood had sprung up on his fingers and his hand, bright and red and oddly hot. He drew a deep breath. He wouldn't save Father with anger. He'd only save him by winning this war, and now he had some chance of doing it. He strode out the next morning with Jory and Tormund Giantsbane, and a company half of proven men and half of the newest volunteers. He'd begun sending such scouting parties out lately, with so many men, all strangers to one another. He needed to give them chances to learn one another, before they might have to stand shoulder to shoulder and fight. And he and his officers needed to learn them as well, which ones were too quarrelsome or too nervy, which ones could be relied upon. He'd brought the woman from Tarth out as well. There were women enough fighting with them. The wildlings expected their stronger women to take up arms, and among the Northmen it wasn't unheard of. But she wasn't either of those, and hadn't any kin or tribe standing behind her. And she was too good at it. Even in that first morning sparring practice, the first measure taken of any new arrival, she'd put every man who came against her into the dirt. More of them had started to line up for the chance, getting their blood up, and John needed to stop it before it turned into something ugly. Rob thought it best he'd take her out for her proving himself. And if she were good enough, he'd ask Lady Mormont to take her among her bannermen. They rode with a motley set of weapons, each of them with two or more. Arrows and spears, clubs and swords. "We need to know just how far we can stretch the dragonglass, too. Even if it does work," Tyrion Lannister had said. "Do we need an entire arrowhead? Or would a little piece do, with a spear behind to shove it through? That would make a very big difference in how many men we can arm." So most of them had only small chips of the stuff, wired into short blades or embedded into wooden clubs. And the two best archers each had one arrow with a head of dragonglass, and two best spearmen carried full blades. The days had already narrowed to the merest sliver of light, a feeble dimness that couldn't reach the ends of the world. The two men in front carried lanterns to light their way when the moon had set, gold light glittering on snow in a long path spilling from the opening in the front, small to keep from spoiling their night vision wholly. They rode 6 days straight out from the wall, heading towards Craster's Keep, without a sight of any moving thing. And then, in the afternoon on the 6th day, the sun already sunk long beneath the horizon. The wind changed to come from the north into their faces, and Greywind growled low in his throat. A moment later, the charnel stink reached their noses, thick and foul, and they had that much warning before the first of the blank-faced women were shambling out of the dark pine shadows towards them, fingers curled like claws around hatchets and cooking knives and pokers, their eyes blue and searing. There were more than 100 wights altogether, some of them little more than rags of flesh and cloth binding together the bones. But the women in the front ranks were dreadfully strong, their bodies fresh and solid. If it hadn't been for the dragon glass, they would have overwhelmed the entire force at once. As it was, Rob had only a moment to shout the order to form circle with the spears around the archers, and then they were surrounded and fighting desperately for their lives, stabbing away at the grabbing hands, trying to keep them off. The chips were enough, in one sense. Even the smallest cut of dragon glass made the whites scream and wail like death all over again, their burning eyes dimming. And when they were pierced to the heart, they fell to the ground as the corpses they ought to have been. But there were too many of them. One of the women fell, and three more pushed forward to take her place. And Rob began to feel as though he could, after all, read a terrible hatred in the emptiness of their faces, the stifled rage of an entire mortal life spent, wasted in fear and misery, and now dredged up in envy against the living who yet had hope, that priceless, shining thing that had slipped away through their fingers. He only had 20 men to start, and then after a handful of minutes, he only had 18. And even as he realized they would soon be drowned beneath the masses of the dead, he saw it. A white walker came out of the trees, mounted on a half-rotted elk-like beast of terrible, ruined grandeur, 30 points spreading from its massive rack of antlers. The walker looked straight at him over the heads of the seething mass of clawing, stabbing hands, the dead growing more frenzied as they tasted blood. Rob met its eyes like a blow to the pit of his stomach and read the satisfaction out of its face. So much for this start. And in kindling rage of his own, he threw down his dragonglass-tipped spear and drew ice instead. He might die here with all his men, and the burden fall upon poor Bran's thin shoulders. But he'd make an answer, at least, and not wait to be dragged down. He swept the sword to either side of his mount, carving a little open space among the wights for him to move. "With me!" he roared. "With me!" And didn't wait to see who followed. He spurred his mount forward, Greywind bringing another white down to make more room. Rob swung again himself, and then the woman from Tarth had jumped from her dying mount and was fighting forward at his right flank to open the path for him, with one of the dragonglass arrows held in one hand like a dagger and a broadsword in the other that she used to hack at limbs long enough to give her an opening to stab. Jory was on his left in another instant, and together they bowled forward. The archers had begun raining arrows ahead of them to cut more space out of the mass of whites, until he broke through and the walker raised a blade and shrieked at him in challenge. Rob charged it with a snarling in his own throat and swung with both hands down onto the walker's blade with his own, one blade of ice against another. The impact resounded through his entire body, a dreadful cold shock washing through him all the way to his heart, locking up his limbs, trying to make his breath seize inside his chest and his throat. The walker hadn't even moved. It just sat, its beast, with a stillness like glaciers, only its arm raised, and its gaze was an impossible weight pressing upon him. Somewhere beyond flesh, looking for any soft weakness to pierce through. Rob couldn't breathe for agony, and at the same time, a blanketing numbness was creeping through him that felt deliciously easeful, a comfort after that first shock, inviting him to sigh out, to be free of pain. He couldn't feel his arms or his hands. But he knew they were there. He clenched himself tight and looked the walker in its terrible glowing eyes, over the bare steel of his own blade, dark and plain against the glowing blue translucence, and held fast to the thought he'd had of Bran, his small, wide-eyed face trying so hard to be brave as he'd watched Rob ride away, thinking of father holding fast himself, alone in the dark. They needed him to be true. The North needed him. And he said, "No," in a bare whisper, forced through his throat. Only that no, and he felt it more than heard his own voice, but it pushed the cold back, a little at first. "No," he said again, stronger, and the cold broke and slid away like a wave on the shore rolling back out of him. It seemed as though the whole world had frozen around them, too. And now the breaking thaw came. The walker's blade burst into a thousand fragments beneath his own, and the momentum carried ice straight down between its neck and shoulder, shattering bone and carving flesh until it was buried halfway down the walker's chest. The walker shrilled a last howl of fury at him, but the light was already going out of its eyes. As it fell backward, sliding off his sword and heavy to the earth, he wheeled around away from it to see all the whites tumbling to the ground like puppets with their strings cut. The blue light was fading out of their eyes, too, and they were only poor dead girls, scattered ungently like old playthings left out of place. Rob sat gasping for breath in the strangely terrible silence. He couldn't feel any joy. There were only 5 men left of his 20. Or rather, 4 men and 1 woman. All of them dismounted and standing like the point of a spear themselves. Behind him, with a great reaping of corpses fanned out around them, as if each one of them had been a hero out of legend to slay 30 to 1. But though there was no room for joy in such a victory, he did feel a rising, ferocious triumph, because they were such heroes. They would be. There would be a legend made of this, of their time. He wouldn't only be leading his men to a last hopeless defense of the world, although he'd been ready to do that, if it was all there was to be done. And he'd had to be ready to do as much, or he'd not have been here to learn what he needed to know. Rob swung down from his mount and went to his last few men, gripping Jory and Brienne by the shoulders, looking them in their faces. Tormund, Sandor Clegane, Alistair Thorne. They were all still half bewildered with both the sudden victory and the dreadful loss. But they reached out to one another, came together in a ring around him, and he said fiercely, "This is how we'll win. The whites aren't the enemy. They're only the fortifications behind which our enemy hides, and all we need to do is make a breach." When Lord Tyrion asked her if she was all right, the night they came back to Castle Black, Brienne only stared at him across the table. She couldn't find an answer, even though she knew she was meant to. And after a moment, he went away. She was sitting alone. Everyone else from her mess had left, and the hall was cold. Dinner was over, and the fires had been allowed to die down. But it was also dim and quiet and smelled so reassuringly of smoke and sweat and porridge. She couldn't make herself get up or move. But after a few minutes, Lord Tyrion came back, toting a jug of wine he'd somehow turned up, and he poured her cup full and slid it back across the table. "You made it back alive," he said. "Drink for the ones who didn't." She did pick up her glass and drink, for that toast, and the wine warmed her through. She took another swallow. "Will you tell me about it?" Lord Tyrion asked. "I know the dragonglass must have worked because some of you came back, and I know it must have been dreadful fighting because so few did. That's all, though." She'd spoken with him enough on the journey north to understand that he wasn't only asking to comfort her. His curiosity was a hunger that could never be satisfied, always looking for more meat. But she also knew that he took what he learned and used it, and he was here to use it for the world. So even though she'd rather have sat in silence, keeping it in her own belly, she said, "The fighting wasn't so dreadful while it was happening. It was just fighting, something trying to kill you and trying to kill it first. Even when we thought we were all going to die, there wasn't anything else to be done. There wasn't a choice to make. Afterwards was worse. They were just girls. Not all of them. There were old whites, old dead too. There were more of those, but they were easier to look at after they'd fallen. They were just bones. But the girls all looked so young. They weren't rotted, they weren't hurt at all, except the ones we'd stabbed ourselves. If you looked close, their throats had been cut. That was all. Sir Alistair told us they'd surely come from Craster's Keep. So after we made a pyre for the dead and made certain it was burning well, Lord Stark said we'd go there and learn what had happened. I've heard some rather unsavory stories about Craster, Tyrion said. Yes, Brienne said, and took another swallow of wine against the sour taste of disgust rising back into her mouth. It took us the rest of the day to walk there. All our horses were dead except Lord Stark's, and it had been hurt, so he didn't want to ride it. When we got there, the holdfast was just deserted, and there wasn't any sign of a fight, so no one was there. We decided to stay the night. It began to snow. It covered our tracks. So when Craster came back a little later, he didn't realize we were there until he'd walked in on us. And he had a girl with him, she went on, having to keep a tight rein on her voice. A little wildling girl, perhaps 10 years old. She'd been beaten with fists. I took her from him and tended her. She told me he'd snatched her from a small cave, a day's ride away, where she'd been hiding with her little brother, her only family left. Their parents had been killed by whites, but the two of them had managed to live there by foraging, and on some dried meat they'd taken from their cellar. She'd fought Craster because he'd taken her and left the boy behind. He was only 5. I went to Lord Stark and asked him to let me go fetch the boy, if I could find him. Craster was telling him some excuse. The wildling army had come through and taken all his wives for whores. He was all alone. The little girl could have died all on her own in the wilds. He hadn't hurt her. After Lord Stark listened to me, Craster began to whine and plead. He didn't have enough food to keep a boy. The army had taken it. He'd been a friend to the Night's Watch for years. He'd saved Benjen Stark's life twice. Lord Stark told him to be quiet. And then he had Grey Wind sniff Craster's hands and the knife on his belt. He led us into the woods a little distance, and we found where he'd done it, where he'd cut all the girls' throats one by one. There were hollows in the snow, all lined up like snow fairies, only with bloodstains at the neck. Tyrion grimaced in horror and disgust. Why? He wouldn't tell us, but Lord Stark was sure he'd given them to aid the Walker in exchange for his own life. He put Craster to death there, in the clearing. Then he had Tormund and Jory take the girl and Craster's horse and go find the boy if they could. He thought it was wise to divide us in any case, so at least one or the other group would make it back to tell everyone about the dragonglass working. Tyrion finished. She nodded. But if you were so outnumbered, how did you survive the attack in the first place? Lord Stark broke our circle of defense to go after the Walker, she said. I thought it was a good idea. We'd still be killed and quicker, but we'd do something more to hurt the enemy. The rest of us started helping to cut him a path towards it. When their blades met, for a moment everything went cold. A cold that was like death. And then there was a sound. She stopped, not because she didn't want to tell him. She suddenly wanted to very badly, to make it a thing that could be said in words. Only she couldn't find them. It needed to be poetry, she thought, and she could only like poetry, not make it. It was like, she stopped again and just shook her head, helplessly. A sound? Tyrion said, prompting. The blades clashing? No, she said. But that did help. It was more like a bell being rung. Only it wasn't really a sound at all. It was like standing near the bell in a sept and feeling it through the air and the stones. I'm sorry, I know I'm not making any sense, she added, seeing Tyrion's frown. That's as close as I can get. Maybe one of the others can do better. But that's what it was like for me. A great bell in a tower being struck hard and ringing true. And then he broke the walker's blade and killed it, and all the wights fell down. Killing the walker killed the wights? Tyrion said sharply, and she nodded, and he blew out a deep breath. Well, that certainly makes a difference. Yes, she said. We don't need to kill the wights. We just need to get through them, to the walkers. Lord Stark said we should think of them as fortifications, not soldiers. Tyrion nodded. Yes, that sounds right, he said. And it also sounds like a very narrow and very lucky escape. I'm glad you made it. But he was already half murmuring, speaking more to himself. He turned inward, thinking over what she'd told him. And she said quietly to draw back his attention. It wasn't luck, Tyrion. He looked up at her. It could have been. It was a good idea. Another commander might have made the same choice and been lucky. But it wasn't luck for him. You've heard the giants say it. The king in the north whose name is Stark. He nodded slowly. When they say king, that's not a treason against King Robert. Because they're not talking about our realm at all. And it doesn't matter whether he's a king or a lord by our laws. What matters is that there's got to be a Stark leading the way against the Night's King. I don't know why it matters, she added, because Tyrion was gazing at her with a drawn frown. I don't know why only a Stark can do it, but I'm sure that's true. I don't mean that Lord Stark is invincible. We could have all been killed out there. He could have been broken when he faced the Walker, but he went the right way. He's the tip of the spear. As long as we follow him, he'll guide us true to the heart of the enemy. And without a Stark in the lead, I don't think we'd find the way, because we won't be lucky the whole time. Lord Tyrion didn't say anything at first. There was a strange, wrenched look on his face, as if someone were hurting him, and he flinched, pressing his hands flat on the table and staring down between them. His mouth worked a little, in a swallow she could see going down his throat. And then he looked up at her and said, in an almost quavering voice, "It sounds as though it would be very bad if anything happened to him." She stared at him, but he lowered his gaze back down away from her. "Yes," she said after a moment, "I think it would be." She reached for the jug and poured a glass and pushed it towards him. He took it, and they sat together in silence, drinking.